Good afternoon and welcome to Women on Wednesdays this academic year. My name is Rebecca Hall and I'm the graduate assistant at the Women's Center. A few things I would like to address before we get started. Please silence your cell phones. Please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speakers. And please remember to fill out the evaluation forms. Your feedback is greatly appreciated for the future programming decisions of the Women's Center. Our series this semester explores compelling voices, decades of courage and activism. Our topic today is titled Challenging Violence Against Women. Local leaders share their stories. Our presenters today will discuss Minnesota being an early leader in the battered women's and anti-rape movements in the 1970s, opening one of the first shelters in the nation in St. Paul. Today, two longtime leaders in the movement to end men's violence against women will discuss what it was like in the early years, areas of change and progress, and the impact of Violence Against Women Act, VAWA. Maxine Barnett recently retired after 33 years as the executive director of Anna Marie's Alliance, formerly the Central Minnesota Task Force on Battered Women. Serving a nine-county area in central and east central Minnesota, Anna Marie's offers shelter and traditional housing, legal advocacy, intervention programs, education, support groups, and many more resources. Today, Maxine has also brought with Kim, which will also be speaking. Peggy Ledoux is a licensed social worker. She is the executive director of the Central Minnesota Sexual Assault Center, serving in this capacity for the last 21 years. The center provides advocacy, support, and referral services to women, children, and men whose lives have been impacted by sexual violence. She is also a member of the governing board of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Sexual Abuse Prevention Network. The Women's Center is very grateful to have our presenters with us here today. Please join us, the Women's Center, in welcoming Maxine Barnett, Peggy Ledoux, and Kim.
Good morning. The word is almost retired.
Yeah.
Okay. Retire.
It will be happening soon, is what I know. Anyway, I'm excited to be here. And what I wanted to do is kind of give you a history, because the shelter here in St. Cloud went through a little bit of ups and downs in getting going. And a lot of it had to do with attitudes in the community at the time. Oh, excuse me. And in the lack of understanding of the issue. And maybe even often lack of acceptance of this as an issue in our community. So along about 1978, a group of women in the St. Cloud community and a number of them from professors from St. Cloud State got together and started talking about, well, they had created a women's center downtown where women could meet and talk about various issues. And out of that came, you know, the issue of violence against women. And at that time, we knew that a shelter had just recently opened in St. Paul and that there were others beginning to open, and talked very seriously about the fact that we need a shelter here in St. Cloud. With that in mind, they set about looking at the possibilities, the probabilities, the stumbling blocks, the barricades, and whatever. But little did they know what kind of barricades St. Cloud could put up in that kind of request. So on February of 1979, the group of women began to meet with the members of the city council. Things did not go extremely well. We don't have battered women in St. Cloud, don't you know? And further, if we did, up jumped three other resources in the community that said, and if that is the case, we will handle it. And one was the Central Minnesota Mental Health Center, one was Catholic Charities, and the third one was Stearns County. And they said, Stearns County said, we've got social workers, they can deal with that. But they don't really have to deal with it very much because it really doesn't happen. And then the same thing came from the therapist's point of view is that, you know, people don't really come in You know, that hasn't really been a big issue. And the question, you know, in the back of all our minds is why, and what is available to them. If somebody is going to come and talk about a serious situation as being abused in their home, and they're not going to be provided any resources or support other than let's see how we can make this work, then it was a moot point. And fortunately, there were exciting and very strong women as a part of that first go-through because, well, Julie Andjeski was one, Kate Kovar from the Mental Health Center, whose boss is over there saying, we take care of things, but she's saying, no, we don't. And Karen Andrews, Gail Polsak, Sudie Hoffman, some of those names you know. Well, they as they got started, they had a first meeting with that city council, and actually the mayor, Al Ayer, at the time, was actually very supportive, but the city council members were not, with the exception of two, George Mishy, and if you know George, George has a long history of being for what's right. That's the way to say it, rather than skimming over other things. It's, you know, it's a, this is an important issue, and we're going to stay with it. And Larry Meyer also was very supportive. The rest of the council was not. They voted at a city council meeting to decline any further discussion about this because it wasn't necessary. Shortly thereafter, they went back to the city council again. And this time, at least, they decided, the city council said, okay, you can have a committee that works together on this. And, of course, on the committee was the head of the Mental Health Center, the head of Caritas, the head of Stearns County. But then they could have their own members, strong women members. And so they did do that. Lots and lots and lots of stop blocks along the way. Again, the other agencies kept saying we can take care of that. But finally, what was happening was the community was coming up forward, reading about it in the paper. There were all these little snippets in the paper about how these meetings are being held behind closed doors, and some persons are invited and some others are not. And so the community became more and more interested and, indeed, more and more supportive. So as time moved on, the St. Cloud Times jumped in, did a poll, and 76% of responders said, we indeed need a shelter. It's time to wake up. So immediately following that, like 2 days later, the city council denies funding. Okay, then United Way stepped in and said, we'll help if you will. Then the city council said, nope, we're still not ready. And this went on, and it went over a long period of time. But one night, a very special night, I was involved by that time, we and a bunch of members in the community said, there's an open forum. So let's get people there. Okay. So packed over 200 people at the city council meeting, and everybody had a right to talk. And there wasn't an end in those days. You went until the constituents were heard. Well, around about 1:30 in the morning, and council members are getting pretty antsy at this time, pretty disgusted, pretty hurry up and finish and whatever. One of them said, let's stop, let's just take a vote. Another one said, oh, let's just give them something. Let's just give them what they want. Well, it wasn't quite what we wanted, but they were able to give us a small house, which started the first shelter. It was over by the children's home, not too far from St. Cloud State, and it was a beginning. It housed six people. The second day we were open, a police car followed by a police car, followed by another police car, came and brought a mom and 10 children from a rural area. The little girl had a note that the mom had pinned inside her collar saying, "Please help us, we're in danger." So that they had brought them in. From that point on, our goal was to really get a big, not only get a bigger shelter, but begin to share in depth throughout the community that the issue of domestic violence is alive and that we are here and that we need your support. And from then on, it began to go up for us. I could tell you many, 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 many stories, and I don't have time because I have to share this with Peggy, and she gets to have time to talk too. So I just want to say that, you know, we did move to a larger house. That was good. Then we ended up, it was an older house, and we bought the house next door and connected the two. And we were there for almost 20 years in that second setting. And then we finally sat down and looked realistically at building a shelter that's a shelter, not old houses. These were not laid out for any kind of privacy, any kind of, you know, little rooms where we could talk to one another. Women could, you know, really have some space. So we were very fortunate to get some property that was donated by the city. And by this time, we had a good, strong relationship with community members in the city. And we had a very generous donor come in who offered the first $500,000 toward our goal of raising money. And we named the shelter after his mother, Anna Marie, who I met. She was an abused woman. For many years, she left her husband with her four little kids and raised them on her own, moved to St. Cloud. And one of her sons had graduated from St. John's, and not in the too past distance. He was an interim director of president of St. John's University. But he is a consistent supporter, remembering what he felt as a child going through that. Where am I? Are you timing me?
She's about 13 after.
Okay, I better go. Okay. Well, I got to move. Anyway, we had a couple of really interesting incidents, too. We were trying to get a domestic abuse policy passed with our law enforcement so that they would get into the picture and start doing something about it. And the Stearns County sheriff decided that he wasn't particularly interested in getting involved in that, but St. Cloud PD was. Well, you know, Stearns County's out there, and there's a lot of people there, and protection is needed. And he refused to come around. So on one bright summer day, everybody got out on the county line. Were you there for that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, we got out on the county line, and you stood in the city part on one side, and then in the county part on the other side. We made sure we had a lot of publicity. That was part of the point. You are safe in the city. You're safe on this side of the line, but you're not safe on the other side. Well, again, this was the age of demonstration, right? Stand up, fight for yourself. And you had to. So that drew another great number of people writing letters. Why is the sheriff's department holding out when the city has adopted this and da-da-da-da-da? So pretty soon we had the policy from the sheriff's department on what they were going to do. We have had such terrific support over the years. It's just amazing. I look at the partnerships that we've developed with the Sexual Assault Center, with the Women's Center on campus, and with community agencies and entities that have been there to support us through these times. And, you know, made lots of legislative changes. I mean, I remember when there wasn't a Domestic Abuse Act, working down at the Capitol, convincing people that this was an important issue, demonstrations, trying to show the need, lots of speaking out. And before I close, and boy, there's a whole bunch I could tell you, because 34 years, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. But we did eventually build a smaller house, which we call the Jill Eckhoff House. And that's for women after they leave the shelter. And it's like transitional living, helping them to reach their goals. And, you know, many go on to school, get their degrees, and move ahead. We also continue to work closely now with all kinds of community members. A strong affiliation, of course, with the St. Cloud Hospital, the emergency room, doctors in the area, informing them. If you notice now, and if they don't ask you when you go for an exam, have you ever been physically abused? They should be. And my doctor does. But, I mean, everybody in that office does. I know that for a fact. And I know it's important, because while everybody isn't going to come up right and say, this is what happened or this is what's happening to me, when asked that in private, it gives them the opportunity to feel like there's a trusting person who will listen. And it's a good way then for the resources to get out to the community and to the people. It's been a wonderful, wonderful part of my life. I will miss it, but we have such great staff. They're doing so many wonderful things. We have now a program called the Children Exposed to Violence Initiative, and it is a model for the nation. We have presented at the World Conference. We have presented that, and now other countries are seeking our assistance in getting this program that truly wraps around what children have experienced, the trauma that they go through when they are living in a violent home. We also have a very specific domestic violence court here in our area, and I'm going to pass it to Kim on that note, because she's a part of that and getting going.
Thanks. I'll just speak here a couple of minutes. My name is Kim Salitris. I'm a criminal justice intervention advocate at Anna Marie's. Just a little history, kind of full circle, is I grew up in a violent home. My mom was my first abuser, and I didn't have any other skills other than to go from abusive relationship to abusive relationship. But I swore that one day I was going to learn enough, and I was going to try and help other people. And so this is an amazing full circle job for me. Our domestic violence court in Stearns County, it's one of a very few around the country. And really what domestic violence court does is it holds the offenders accountable, and it also wraps around the victims. We have county prosecutors, we have defense attorneys, we have judges, we have legal aid attorneys, we have probation officers, we have child protection services. All of us come together and wrap around and find out how we can stop the repetitiveness. We found that the majority of the felony offenders keep reoffending. And how do we stop that? And how do we try and really get the services that victims are needing? Victims are saying, hey, but he's my child care provider. Or I can't afford this apartment on my own. Or I don't have a job, I don't have skills. And so this is something that we wrap around, and that we give that victim what she's looking for, depending, you know, doesn't matter what part of the criminal process. And also we're holding offenders accountable more often. When they are members of the domestic violence court, there's weekly compliance hearings where these offenders need to go to court every Thursday. There's a strict curfew, abstention, but what also is happening, which I think is a good thing, is that these offenders are also being subjected to and getting services set up for them, treatment, chemical dependency issues, MRT, moral recognition therapy. And what we're finding is that these offenders are not reoffending in near the capacity that they were. It's making a difference. Our organization working closer and closer with law enforcement to get to these victims immediately instead of 2 days later when, gee, the bruises are not so fresh anymore. Gee, it wasn't so bad. Maybe I deserved it. But to be able to get to those victims immediately rather than 2 days later, we're finding that they are receiving services and wanting to receive services a lot more often. So law enforcement is really becoming on board with that as well. So that's kind of some of the wonderful things that are happening since this movement has started. I know that when I tried to receive help back in the day, they told me that I wasn't ready to leave yet. And that was pretty powerful for me, and it made me really mad when I'm like, do you really think that I like getting the crap beat out of me? And you're going to tell me when I'm reaching out for support, you're just going to tell me that I'm not ready to leave yet? And that isn't what it's like anymore. So I'm going to turn it over to Peggy because the Sexual Assault Center also does a lot of really amazing work, and we're fortunate to be working with them. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Kim and Max. I'm really appreciative of being able to collaborate with other services in the community, like Anna Marie's and the Women's Center on campus. And like Max said, we have some pretty amazing nonprofits in the area. And I think we are kind of a unique community that they do attempt to network and collaborate quite well and try to stay away from the protecting turf and competitive kind of mentality. So it's that piece is kind of refreshing. I wanted to just do a real brief history of why our services exist. It really comes out of what's called crime victim services. And before the 1970s, crime victims, number one, didn't have any rights whatsoever that were protected, and there was not any money legislated to provide crime victims any services. In 1970 was the first rape crisis center to be offered in Minnesota, and 1971 was the first battered women's shelter in St. Paul. And then about 1985, we really started passing some crime victim rights. And so there is a crime victim bill of rights that has to be adhered to, and it is good because if they're not followed, a crime victim has a way to object to how a case was handled. For example, in 1988, it became part of the Bill of Rights that crime victims have the right to do a victim impact statement during sentencing hearing. And that can be very, very powerful. And I do believe that there are times it has impacted the judge,
yes,
when they hear from the victim and the victim's family. And because judges in the state of Minnesota have a lot of power as far as the actual sentence that is given out. You know, our juries do not make the sentencing decision in our state. So crime victim rights have been really powerful in the state, and we had one of the first offices in the nation to protect crime victim rights. It was called the Crime Ombudsman Office, and now it's called the Office of Victims Justice Unit, mm-hmm. something like that. Office of Victims Justice Unit, something like that. So it's kind of neat being in this state because we really have done a lot to be a leader in the nation. And as far as the Sexual Assault Center, very grassroots kind of beginnings, like a lot of the things, you know, the demonstrations that Max talked about, but really grassroots in that it was just a group of women in the community in 1976, and they just started talking at the Women's Center that Max talked about that they had downtown, and they said, you know what? You know, we know so many women that are being raped and there aren't any services out there. Criminal justice system isn't responding. We really need to start organizing around this issue. And so they developed their own curriculum to try to do a training for volunteers. And they used the phones at that women's center to start the very first crisis line, which really got up and running in 1977.
And then in 1984, the Sexual Assault Center became legally incorporated in the state of Minnesota as a private nonprofit and has operated ever since as a private nonprofit. And, you know, I've been at the center for quite a while, and I've seen a lot of changes. But I really want to tell you that this work is, number one, it's very interesting because I've worked at the center for a long time, and I can honestly and sincerely say I've never, ever had two identical work days in that entire time. Just because of all the different cases and the different situations and what you're called out to do. So I can honestly say I'd never, ever have been bored, have been exposed to some pretty horrific things to potentially have secondary trauma reactions to, but I have never been bored and have always been very, very honored to be allowed for the victim survivors to allow me to witness them in their most vulnerable time. And there's a lot of individuals, you know, it's always kind of not real exciting happy hour talk when you're meeting new people, socializing, and they always say, well, where do you work? Oh, I work at the Sexual Assault Center. Oh. Yeah. And then it's kind of like people either back away from you or they go into total denial. Well, what do we need one of those here for? We don't have rape in this area. Or how can you possibly do that kind of work? So we have a joke at the Sexual Assault Center that when we're out socializing and people ask us where we work, we say we work at a flower shop. You know, kind of benign, no reactions, don't have to deal with all those kinds of issues. Yeah, it works really well, except we got caught one time by an intoxicated person that wanted to know the exact flower shop we worked at because they wanted to order some flowers on Monday. So we were kind of stuck there, like, oh, now what do we say? So I think we went out and danced with the person and got him off topic. So we are one of the higher volume centers in the state of Minnesota. We have between 300 to 450 new cases of sexual assault every 12-month period. And we have between 3,000 and 5,000 times that we actually have contact with a victim and provide a service. Mm-hmm. So a really high volume center. We have between 110 and 130 actual hospital cases where we actually arrive as part of a response team at the area emergency rooms for a sexual assault that has just occurred, and we're responding as a team. We have done some amazing work that I think has created some progress simply because of the VAWA Act, the mm-hmm. Violence Against Women Act, which one of my fantasies in life, I really want to meet Senator Biden, or at least not Senator now, he's Vice President. But he was amazing. He was one of the first authors of the Violence Against mm-hmm. Women Act and really had his staff do a lot of research. And I think he's pretty amazing pioneer in that it was a male senator that did the Violence Against Women Act. Mm-hmm. And we have gotten a lot of grants over the years to do special projects. We have brought the Southern Police Institute to St. Cloud. It was one of the first trainings held at the new St. Cloud Police Department. We trained a lot of officers, I think it's about 56 officers in the area, on state-of-the-art interviewing techniques and how to work with victim survivors of sexual violence. It really is a unique crime. Almost always it's a felony crime, so we deal with the laws a little bit different than domestic violence because that only reaches felony levels in certain different cases. Mm-hmm. And so typically, over the years, just like domestic violence, sexual assault victims are often blamed. And we still, unfortunately, are not seeing a lot of progress in an increase in charging and prosecution rates. We have made huge progress in developing team approaches where, you know, some of you are probably aware that it is the most underreported crime in our country today. Any sexual violent crimes are the most underreported crimes, even way underreported compared to domestic violence. It really is the last issue to come out of the closet. Domestic violence programs have done a lot to get their issue out in the open. I think because we have the word sex in it and we don't have healthy sexuality in this society, people just do not want to look at this issue and think that it is real. And so there's a lot of victim blaming and not a lot of response. I do think it's positive that locally we have very high reporting rates. Nationally, only between 10 and 20% of all sexual assaults that occur ever end up being reported to law enforcement. We're seeing some quarters of our statistics services that we are seeing up to 70% of our cases being reported to law enforcement. Now, some of you might be going, well, what the heck? Why is that a good deal? Because we're not seeing higher charging and conviction rates. The reason that I still believe it is positive is that it does show we're doing better as a team approach, and victims have more confidence that they're going to be believed and treated sensitively by medical personnel, law enforcement, and advocates. And we have been able to connect cases to the same perpetrator. Mm-hmm. We had a case in Sherburne County where a single father with a couple children was hiring babysitters and sexually assaulting them, coming home early from whatever he told them he was going to do. We had two victims come forward and report, and there was not enough evidence to do anything with the case. Delayed reporting, those kinds of issues that were problematic. I thought the father on the second case literally was going to literally harm the man and him end up in prison, but we worked with him to stay safe and not have that happen. We had a third victim come forward who did report. After the next day, she happened to work at the guy's daycare where his children were. He got so brazen and so into his dominance and power and control, thinking he was getting by with this, right? Nothing was happening to him. He went to pick his children up at the daycare, and he threw a little pharmacy bag at his latest victim because she worked there. He made sure they were alone in a room, and he said, hey, make sure and take this. Guess what was in the bag? He went out and bought emergency contraception. And so that made her angry enough that she did report. And so sometimes you're able to connect the dots on those cases that it's extremely frustrating that we aren't seeing a huge number of our cases being charged. And of the numbers that we're lucky enough to get charged, we're not seeing high conviction rates. Just to give you the sorry statistic, we're only currently seeing 12% of our cases even being charged. So a lot of sex offenders out there with lots of victims that are never, ever charged. As you know, historically, we do have sex offender registration in this state, and that's a good thing, but it certainly is not that much of a protective thing, because we need to accept the reality that sex offenders are in our education systems, they're in our religious communities, they're in our communities. Sex offenders live among us, and we have to break out of denial and to really accept awareness about this issue, or we're never going to impact the issue. Obviously, gender issues are huge. Why are high rates of sexual violence happening? I believe in a feminist analysis of that to a certain degree, that we still continue to teach little boys that they need to be powerful and in control to prove their masculinity. And we're still teaching little girls that, you know, they have to wear the right clothes, not for their own self-fulfillment, but so they can attract men and, you know, all of the sexist gender role stereotypes. And if we don't start breaking down gender role stereotypes, sexual violent rates are not going to go down. Just want to talk to you about some of the changes that I am seeing. Some of the changes have to do with child sexual abuse. Every year, between 50 and 51% of all of those cases I quoted to you do involve victims under the age of 18. So children in our communities are being sexually assaulted. And huge denial for people responding to this. People are not reporting it. Children are very often just not believed. We have children that are actually disciplined by adults for saying such a thing. How can you say that about so-and-so? So we are not seeing a huge response to that. There are some positives happening with that. The Center for Disease Control currently defines child sexual abuse as a public health risk. And they have defined it as intentional injury and harm to children that is preventable. And I think when we reframe an issue like that, it takes some of the scariness away in the sexual arena, and I think people are starting to approach it differently. The other positive I'm seeing in the last couple of recent years, we are starting to realize that the only way we're going to impact the rates of sexual violence, you know, separate from blasting down the gender role stereotypes, is we need to get at this at a policy level. And the example that's always used is different age groups in here, but some of us in this room remember, number one, cars never had seat belts. And as children, we used to roll around in that shelf on that back window and look at the sky, sure. And wow, this is cool. Oh, look at those clouds. You know, play the name the cloud thing. And then they passed, we started seeing high numbers of children dying in crashes. And so they passed legislation that you have to have your child in a car seat. Parents blocked it at first. You show up at the hospital and they say you can't take your child out of the hospital unless you put him in the seat. And parents were like, don't tell me what I can do with my child. It's my child, and I'll let my wife hold him in her arms if she wants to. I mean, there was that kind of reaction. People don't question it now, right? You used to drive by and still see unrestrained children in cars. Very rare. Think of the smoking issue. Do you know that the guy that started causing the no smoking zones and, getting the no smoking going and writing books about it, he was approached by the tobacco million-dollar corporations and said they would publish his book. They would pay for this book he wanted to publish, and they would help him distribute his book on one condition, that he quit his policy work because they knew it would affect tobacco sales. I think we have to approach sexual violence this. We need to get creative. We need to get at the policy level to really get some ideas going in our society that we're not going to tolerate sex offenders anymore. We're not going to let them continue to get by with it, and only 12% of them are being charged and convicted and end up being registered on sex offender registry. So I think there's some positive things. The changes I have seen over the years that are really significant to me, again, kind of have to do with gender. We're seeing a lot higher number of male victims having the courage to come forward and some awareness about male victim issues. We're seeing more men wanting to volunteer at the center, which is exciting to me because if men don't start confronting other men on their sexism, again, we're not going to impact the issue. Guess what? If I confront a man about his sexism, I'm probably just going to be called a blank and bitch. If a male would confront a peer male on their sexism, they might be more likely to listen to it. Very exciting for me to see more men come forward and want to volunteer at the center. So get the word out there. We're looking for that. We always give victims the opportunity to tell us if they have a gender preference of who they want to talk to. And the women that have talked to males that are working on the crisis line, we've actually had calls the next day at the center and saying, I need to tell you that was a really neat experience for me because, quite frankly, I hate all men. I kind of look at all men as perpetrators since I've been raped 3 or 4 times. And that guy was really sensitive to me, and it was a positive experience in my healing. So there's some gender differences in that. Male victims in the past, when we'd give them a gender preference of who they wanted to talk to, and I've only seen this change in the last 3 or 4 years. If you'd ask a male victim calling, do you want to talk to another guy? Invariably, 99.9% of the time, you'd hear them kind of start breathing faster and sound kind of panicked. Why would I want to talk to another guy about this? And they would prefer to talk to a female. When we offer that now, I'm amazed how many men will stop and just go, you know what, it would be kind of neat to talk to another guy. What gives me hope about that is that maybe gender roles and the stereotypes about how men interact, how women interact with each other, and how men and women interact, I've got to have some hope that that is changing and that there will be some positive changes that have a ripple effect to that. Last minute things. The other positive thing in the state of Minnesota right now, a Child Victims Act is before the legislature. It is through 2 committees clearing the way for it to be brought on the House floor. The Child Victims Act will really deal with the statute of limitation on civil cases. I do not believe civil lawsuits are the remedy for all victims that have experienced sexual violence as children. But I do believe that it has the potential to impact the issue. Sexual harassment in this society was never taken seriously. I walked into a place once where there was a little sign back behind the counter that said, sexual harassment is not against the law here, it's a privilege of the job. You don't see that anymore. And you know why? Because corporations lost literally millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I hate to say it comes down to money sometimes, but that's our society. And so I do believe that the Child Victims Act that will deal with the statute of limitations on civil cases, suing institutions that are covering it up. Penn State's a great example, one of the recent high profile. If people aren't going to get by with that anymore, we're going to have a better response and impact sexual violence. How many people signed the petition for CNN to make a response to the reporter that, yay, thank you for signing the petition, that CNN needs to respond to their reporter that never said one word about the impact on the victim, but was so worried about these poor guys. And now texts are coming out publicly that they went to their coach and the coach told them that he was going to help them cover it up. And now there's a petition calling for firing that coach. These are the kind of actions we need to get outraged. I think we've kind of lost our anger in our society and gotten way too used to domestic violence and sexual violence being the norm. Where is your outrage? Get in touch with your outrage and take action in whether it's calling your legislators about passing the Child Victims Act or whatever it is. Get outraged and get out there and carry your picket signs or call your legislators and impact the issue. Confront your peers on their sexism. Huge impact on the future of sexual violence. So we're supposed to leave the last so many minutes for questions, comments, challenges, whatever you want to say to us. Thank you for listening.
I wanna piggyback on something that Peggy said, and that is... I did get the opportunity to meet Joe Biden, and I have a picture of Joe and I on my refrigerator, and I will call Joe and see if he can set up something with you, Peggy.
Awesome.
Okay? Good.
Few fantasies can come true, maybe.
You know, one of the things that, too, I wanted to mention was, you know, the incredible statistics, the numbers of people that we are serving right now. It's incredible. Like, last year, we served 1,700 unduplicated people at the shelter. And that's a lot of folks that need a lot of one-to-one time, a lot of kids that need to be wrapped around. And it's incredible. So, you know, as much as we think we've made an impact and that this is slowing down, the more we realize we're not there. We're not, it's still something that's not been comprehended by our society at large, that violence against women continues, and we have to be there and we have to stand up for women. And we are fortunate too to have a tremendous volunteer force of men working at the shelter, and particularly we have one guy in our that's an employee in our children's program who is so wonderful as a positive a role model and also a friend to the kids. I mean, a real, true listener. And that's so important. And like I said, we need to know, and I know it, you know, but how children are impacted by these horrible things. Even if the child has never hit, what they see and how devastated they become is incredible. And the picking up the pieces and helping them to understand and move forward, and no, they don't understand, but the healing piece is so critical. So anyway, those are just a couple of final comments. And we're certainly open to questions. We have a whole stream of services, you know, and a whole stream of public awareness. We've got this whole new program called Connect, Building a Healthy Relationship Community. So instead of going at the issue of domestic violence from a negative, we shouldn't have domestic violence, is how are we connecting in our workplaces, in our homes, in a positive way? What are we doing to foster that? And that's taken off really, really well. In fact, now all the Twin Cities shelters want us to teach them the curriculum because we wrote it and copyrighted it. Cool. So anyway, now we can have questions. Look at how good we were. Yeah. Nobody has any. Another thing is you certainly... Okay.
If you have, say, a neighbor you think is being abused, what do you do?
Good question.
Well, one of the things that we do is encourage you to let the neighbor know that you are available to talk. You notice some things that might not be going so well if you ever want to talk, you know, that kind of thing. And you can go even a step further depending on, you know, what's your relationship with that neighbor and say, you know, I've noticed that, you know, you're having kind of a difficult time. You know, there's a group of people over at Anna Marie's or the Sexual Assault Center that are great. They'd love to talk to you and they're well open and, yeah.
An anonymous 911 call, if you're hearing that things are escalating, if you are like, oh my gosh, someone is getting hurt in there or there's... Call 911. You know, there was a murder, Sauk Rapids year before. Yeah. There was screaming, and not one neighbor called.
And it was an apartment complex. And so there was a lot of people around.
So call 911 if you're, you can do that anonymously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you share a story that illustrates, like a strategy for change? Or again, you told some about, you know, working with the city council.
Yeah, yeah.
Working with the community. So just a story that either enrages us or inspires us to continue working on this issue.
You mean one that's happened?
Yeah. Oh. A story that you have based on. Yeah.
I can think way back when the first cell phone company came to town. I don't remember what they were called.
Cellular?
Cell 2000, was it? Something like that. Anyway, they had a, I don't know if you remember this, Jane. One of their big advertisements was the black and white old-fashioned movie, which, you know, I suppose some people thought it was funny, but it was a woman that was about ready to go through a buzzsaw. You know, they had her tied up, and we had some people call the center and say, wow, that's... We realize they think it's funny because it's old black and white movie, but, you know, that's really violent, you know, tying a woman up, throw her through a buzzsaw. And I said, what do you want to do about it? Start some activism, make some phone calls, write some letters. And this person got super into it. They not only pulled that ad locally, they pulled that ad nationally. And that was just one of those examples of somebody just, like, I think this is terrible. This woman ready to go through the buzzsaw. I don't care if people think it's funny because it's old-fashioned. It's violence, and the person got satisfaction with that kind of activism. And that's just a simplistic thing of sometimes you start something that small and it actually gets results.
Mm-hmm. On another note, you know, stopping and thinking about when you're talking about the cell phones, because they're a lifesaver, I'll tell you right now. And it was because of Sheila Wellstone's that we were the first shelter in the United States to be able to put cell phones into battered women's hands. And now, I shouldn't say hands, shoulders. I mean, these were the big battery packs, you know. Like, you can hide this from him? I don't think so. But so, especially for some of the rural women, there were places on the farm that they could hide them. Unfortunately, on one occasion, that didn't work, and that woman was murdered. But, we have to think, I keep thinking broadly of all the different kinds of things that happen, like that, like Sheila sitting down, going to the cellular industry in D.C. and saying, this is what we need cell phones for. This is what we need phones for. Get them out there. Get them going. And now we do. Verizon and everybody else has picked up, and they provide phones for battered women. Really? People have commitments. Any others? Or even if you don't have a question, an idea, a comment, come on over, volunteer. I have a three-page prepared statement.
So just a final, do you have a final comment?
I guess I would just like to say, because such a high percentage of our cases are children, you know, minors under the age of 18, listen to children, believe children. I'm really passionate about that issue because so often the children continue to live with the perpetrator. One final thing, tell children that it's okay to break a secret and that it's really a good thing to get help with a big, scary secret when somebody bigger than them told them never to tell the secret. I've interviewed lots of sex offenders, worked with adolescent sex offenders. It sounds like a simplistic word in the English language. It's very powerful. So we just need to talk to children about that simple little tool that, you know, if you ever have a big, scary secret, it's okay, and it's a good thing to get help with that secret. That's my final tool to try to save children. We have 60 million survivors of child sexual abuse in this country today. That's 20% of our U.S. population. It's a huge, huge issue.
You have a one? You want to say?
I guess, and we did kind of talk about this a little bit, but that one of the big things is changing our dialogue. Changing our dialogue. There was one day, I'm a student here on campus as well, where my brother-in-law sent me a text. My brother-in-law sent me a text saying, "I like my women like I like my donuts, battered."
That was supposed to be funny.
And he thought it was supposed to be. This is my brother-in-law who knows kind of my history, who kind of knows what I do for a living. And it's about standing up and saying, "That's not funny." And so it is. It's really about, I think a lot of it is changing our dialogue. That's my last
one. My last one is continuing to hold the criminal justice system accountable, continuing to make sure that they're doing their part and that the penalties are strict and that they follow through. I think we've made huge strides. We can make more strides, and we need to keep doing that. And the other thing is to somehow move this from not just something I could get involved in, but as a practice. How are we enriching people's lives rather than tearing them down? What is it that helps us to be able to build with others rather than only step up at a moment of tragedy? The stories of domestic violence are not one incident. That is a given. So we need to be able to be looking at this from dealing with the people who are being abused, but broaden it into growing a healthy relationship community. How are we with each other every day? Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.